I never had any friends later on like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus. Did you?
That's one of my most favorite quotes from any Stephen King. Well done.
For our listeners, we do not discuss what the quotes are ahead of these recordings. So I always find it amusing when out of the tens of thousands of words in these books, we end up gravitating towards the same phrases.
Welcome back to Literary Guys. We're talking about Stephen King's The Body, later adapted into the amazing Rob Reiner film Stand By Me. I'm author Zachary Kellyan.
And I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan. I actually thought this was adapted into the movie Clue about Mr. Body.
Oh, that's very good. What is your favorite ending of the movie Clue?
Well, I will say that the 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 1, or 1 plus 2 plus 1 plus 1, sequence is one of the best bits of Tim Curry logic that I've ever heard.
But we're not here to talk about Clue or the great works of Tim Curry or Michael McKean. We were talking about another master of his form, Stephen King, specifically his novella, The Body. And I love that quote that you chose, because while our experiences may have differed as 12-year-old boys in terms of the friendships we formed, I really do think the core of this novel is relatable to anybody in terms of the importance of friendship and the dynamic of friendship. And I think King captures it so beautifully between these four boys.
They play off each other.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it's something about that age. And again, I'm extrapolating a little bit because this is different than the friendships I had when I was 12. But I can definitely see it in the story, which is that while each one of these boys is a unique character coming from his own background and own motivations, that they're all constantly being influenced by each other, being goaded by each other, telling wild stories, amping up the legends that they're hearing, like we talked about last time with this dog Chopper. Like,
yeah.
There's this dynamic, and there's something as an adult which is enviable about it. And it's really hard to latch onto exactly what that is, but it's that innocence somewhere in there that it allows for a level of silliness and of, I don't know, like there isn't a huge weight associated with every decision that they make. And because of that, the legend and the, you know, the stories they tell each other can be outrageous. And they can be pressuring each other into doing silly things. And there's so few consequences here. Ironically, the biggest consequence that exists in the story at the end is that the boys all get beaten up for what they ultimately do. And yet they seem to wear it as a badge of honor of the exploits that they had.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of tie-ins I think we could make, even though this is a story of a bunch of 12-year-old boys in Maine hiking to see a dead body, with James Michener's Bridges at Toko Ri, where it is about those bonds that are formed between men or between boys in times of chaos or struggle. And you just know, even though it's very clear by the end of this novella that things are never really going to be the same between these four, you just know that for as long as their life will let them, they're all going to look back on this moment with fond memories. And I do think about that. You know, when I was 12, was that the best years of my life? No, but I have so many fond memories of that era that I don't necessarily have from other years. And I think King gets the archetype so well. Like, I literally had a friend who would, you could obviously question the parenting background he came from, but he would dress all in black and play chicken with cars at night because he thought it was hysterical. And the fact that Teddy does this with trucks and trains is like, yeah, in my mind, we all knew a kid like that. Now, maybe Dr. Gordon McCallan did not, because all his friends were either actual 40-year-old men or 12-year-olds quickly on their way to 40. But I think most of our listening audience, I would assume, maybe fell into that other camp where they kind of had a lot of those kids that are like this. And I think that there's this purity, and you said innocence, that exists there, where rarely is a kind word spoken between these four.
Yeah, very seldom.
Except when it matters. They kind of seem to know when pushing something is too far. They know when it's okay to make fun of someone's mom, but maybe not okay to make fun of his dad because his dad went Section 8. There's this beautiful little nuance part that maybe you didn't pick up on if you only read this once, but Gordy lost his older brother, didn't right. have a very distant relationship with this kid, but it wasn't a bad relationship either. And one of the things his older brother taught him was how to shuffle cards. In fact, he can shuffle cards better than anyone.
Yeah, the other boys look up to him for it.
They do. And in fact, they want him to teach them how to shuffle cards. But the one kid that never asks him, this kid who I think we'll end up talking about in this episode and probably for sure in episode 3, is Chris. Chris kind of understands that that's one piece of Gordon's brother, Gordon from the novella, not the Gordon sitting across from me, that he doesn't want to give away. There's only so much of Dennis that he ever got, therefore there's only so much he could ever give away. And that nuance that a 12-year-old can kind of recognize that and just know, like, hey, he's proud of how he shuffles his cards, but that's something between him and his brother, and I'm not going to broach that, is beautiful. And I think for all the advancements that we would expect from adults, I find very few adults have that subtlety and that ability to kind of empathize with somebody else like a 12-year-old boy can show when it really matters.
Well, I think that Chris is a very special character. I think we'll touch on that a bit later. And the insightfulness he shows in that is not the only time in which he is able to almost transcend his age. I want to get back to something that you mentioned just a minute ago, because I think it's an interesting way of looking at this book, which is this a war novel? Is Stephen King borrowing the tropes of a war novel and the sort of things that we see in that and overlaying that into a story about 12-year-old boys? Like, I'm reminded of a quote from, and this is actually quite pertinent to what we've covered here in Literary Guys, from The Talented Mr. Ripley, but not from Patricia Highsmith, but instead from Anthony Minghella's screenplay, which is Gwyneth Paltrow's character, Marge Sherwood, that she asks, why is it that when men play, they always play it more?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's certainly intentional in the course of this novella. I mean, you get references to Chris as a platoon leader taking the lead. When they dive off the railroad tracks, it's paratroopers over the side or something like that. I mean, in their minds, I think they're a little bit playing at war. And it's partially of the time. I mean, you're just coming out of the Korean War right now. Tensions with communism are leading us into the Vietnam War. So I think that's a lot of what these kids know at the time. Their grandfathers fought in a war, their dads fought in a war. They are probably anticipating they will too be conscripted into the army and fight in a war. But I think it goes beyond that too, because I do think we talk a lot about nature versus nurture in our society nowadays, and that gender's a construct and all of that. And I think it's a welcome discussion, and I think it's always very interesting, and there's plenty of nuance to it. But my personal experience is that, you know, if men have been the ones asked predominantly to go to war for thousands of years, at some point, that's going to be baked into our instincts, baked into our DNA. My parents are very much pacifists. I was raised in an atheist household by parents who taught me to hate guns, would never let me have a toy gun, and yet some of my earliest memories are picking up sticks and pretending they were guns. And so I think that there is something that's kind of baked into our DNA as biological men that make us feel like we need to prepare for some type of conflict.
So I think the conflict is one thing. But again, going back to books that we've talked about before, the camaraderie, I think is really the salient point here. The way in which we saw the connection of the characters in the Bridges of Toko Rhee, for instance, connecting with what we're seeing here between these four boys, that somehow there was a bond there. And yes, things happened which ultimately caused this group to disband in the end. This is not a giant spoiler here, that not everything is going to end up hunky-dory here. But we see that during this time of battle, as it were, that these boys would protect each other. They would throw each other in the line of fire, if such a thing existed here. That there is this camaraderie of troops marching into battle. And the battle happens to be this reconnaissance, if you want to call it, of this body. But does that really make it that much different than 25-year-old men who are trying to take a hill against impossible odds?
Well, you can see these kids who would have grown up surrounded by war, whose male figures, the male authorities in their life, had been through war. Perhaps that's their only entry point into male intimacy. You know, we see there's that great, going back again to last season, The Bridges at Toko Ri, there's that moment where the protagonist's wife flies all the way across the world to see him in Japan, and yet he almost instantly ditches her to go bail one of his war buddies out of jail. And there's just that understanding that, listen, like, this is what happens to men in wartime, and I can't let this man down. And I think that this adventure in this novella to go see this Ray Browers, I think it is, this boy who's been presumably hit by a train while he was out berry picking, is their cipher for that. It's their proxy for going to war, because they love each other, these four kids. Particularly Gordy and Chris have this amazing bond that, man, you would have loved to see that flourish into adulthood, because gay or straight, the intimacy that two men can have for one another just as friends is so powerful, and it's something we see so rarely. And certainly in the 1950s and 60s, probably the only time these kids saw it was with their dad's wartime buddies.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what we're seeing here, and I think King plays very brilliantly off that trope.
I think this is a fascinating thing to explore, because I think that there are few socially acceptable ways in which men can express that sort of intimacy. This is not a sexual discussion at all.
Right.
This is about an emotional intimacy.
Platonic love.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And so what we're seeing here is that we as a society have denigrated that so much that there are very few remaining outlets and topics for which an outpouring of that kind of love is acceptable and not frowned upon. And I think at this point in time that the wartime story, the connection that exists between comrades, is probably one of at most a handful of ways which that can be expressed without it being looked at as something which is, and unfortunately using this term in a derogatory manner, which is, you know, otherwise it would be looked on as being very gay.
And that comes up a lot in the novel, right? Where it's the, I do know the term they use, and I prefer not to use it on this podcast or ever, but their version of quote unquote no homo, where they want to express intimacy for one another, but they don't want to seem like the F word.
The character uses the word.
Yeah.
And immediately Stephen King, as the ersatz narrator, regrets that he, as a young man, used that terminology, knowing far better in his age that it was not an appropriate thing to say.
The word we're talking about, obviously, FAG, or the variations thereof. And I think you and I grew up in the 80s, 90s. I feel like that term was still used, and both derogatorily to refer to homosexuals, but also just to refer to weakness or emotional outbursts or anything that separated you as an other from a male group.
Or due to my Anglophile nature, to refer to a cigarette.
I do think that that probably distanced you from other 12-year-olds when you were constantly asking for one.
You know what? This actually is making a lot of sense the more we talk about it, so yes.
But yeah, I think we're hitting on something really interesting here, because I thank goodness that we don't live in that world currently, but I still think there's enough vestiges of that world where, just looking back to 1959, we can really relate to it. I think there are more emotional outlets for men to have with one another. There is a greater sense of community amongst men, that we didn't have to survive a hailstorm of bullets in a foxhole to have that kind of connection. But it is still a struggle. It is still a little bit more of a journey than it might be for some other genders to reach that point. And again, it's one of the reasons I love The Body so much, is because I think it gets that purity of male relationships that we so rarely see in other literature.
One thing I will say to the credit, I think, of masculinity and of men, is once that level of male intimacy has been achieved, it is something which I think is very genuine and in its own way pure. That I think that is something which, because it is so difficult to get there and is frowned upon by, still to this day, male society, that it is something that is very respectable and very pure, because at that point, like, it was against the odds of what society says that men should behave as.
Well said. Yeah, I think there's a broad stereotype, but in my experience, it has been true that there are a lot more disingenuous female friendships. The women that I've dated, the female friends that I've had, I've often heard them speak about some of their female friends in negative terms. They don't like so-and-so, but so-and-so's still in their clique, so it's like whatever. And I don't experience that so much with men. I do feel like there is, in the rare cases that you are able to build a truly strong bond with a man, it is something that lasts forever. Yeah. You know, one of the things that is interesting to me about our relationship, I have a lot of great male friends. I'm very lucky to count many, many men as truly good friends, on par with the great Dr. Gordon McCallum sitting across from me. But you have one distinction that all my other friends don't. I don't think we've ever been in a fist fight with one another.
We have not.
No, and certainly all
we have witnessed fist fights together.
Many drunken times in Ireland, we have seen fist fights and even placed bets on them. But much like the characters in this novella, I think they've all probably fought each other. They fight each other a couple times in the course of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I've fist fought all of my guy friends, which seems totally incongruous with an intimate relationship. But there's something intimate about that. And I can't quite put my finger on why. I know certainly you and I, personality-wise, that wouldn't make any sense. I don't know that you've ever been in a fight. We've talked about this during Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't been in a fight. But I also think perhaps it took us longer to get to this level of intimacy that we have now than maybe, you know, just drawing blood from a couple guys on a playground and then all of a sudden, quote-unquote, like wartime. Now we've been in that foxhole together. Now we can be honest about our emotions and honest about our intimacy with one another.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, since we're using the term intimacy in a platonic way, I also think that we have an opportunity here to talk about passion in a platonic way as I think what you're talking about, and yes, it likely is infused with a certain amount of alcohol that leads to 2 a.m. fistfights at a Irish pub, and by which I mean in Ireland, not a pub in Kirkland, for instance. Rip the Wilder over, by the way. Sad loss due to COVID. But I think that we're in this state where when guys know each other, they're not afraid to be honest and frank and provocative with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that sort of no filter, if you want to call it that, it can lead to heightened passion around ideas and around allegiances, and it leads to fights. Because we let our guard down when we're around people for whom we trust. And therefore, like, we're not putting on airs, to use the term that I think you said earlier, and therefore we're opening ourselves up to perhaps some additional confrontation as a result.
Yeah, we see that with the characters in this novella, and if we were ever 12-year-old boys, we saw that probably a lot in our own lives. There's this feeling that to be passionate about something, whether it's your hidden writings like Gordy in The Body, or it's a friendship that you have with another man, it's often derided. But if you can overcome that together,
yes,
that is where the strength in friendship lies. And I think that that's a really beautiful lesson to learn.
So it's a great segue, because you're talking about the stories that Gordy writes in his head, sometimes writes down, that there is a man, David Hogan, who he imagines, who he comes up with a not so nice name for, who is very interested in winning a pie eating contest in his own way. And I think this is a wonderfully strange story that Gordy decides to tell his compatriots while they're out camping on their way out to see this body. Because it isn't about winning in a traditional way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about the story?
Yeah, well, and I'm curious, just anecdotally, how did you feel as a first-time reader of this? You've got this and Stud City, these two completely out-of-place narratives that are presented to us as if they were previously published stories in literary magazines that are being reprinted here with permission from the magazine, but of course are still constructs of this fictional universe. Did that work for you, or did that take you out of the narrative?
It took me out a little bit, because I felt like Stud City felt like work for hire. This story of David Hogan, it felt like the juvenile writings that would probably not ever be published.
I love this story, and I think one of the things, if the stories are a very, again, unique part of this structure that we talked about in our first episode of The Body, but I think what's really interesting is maybe I just find it interesting as a writer myself. You're seeing the ersatz thoughts of a burgeoning writer, right? Where he's kind of taking some, maybe even subconsciously, taking some of his own pain and his own subconscious and planting it into his story. So with Stud City, of course, we see perhaps resentment he has a little bit for his brother through the character of Chino. And then, of course, in the Lardass Hogan story, we see that he is kind of processing a lot of that juvenilia in a kind of interesting counterculture way. For me, those of you who've already read this, you know, obviously, Lardass Hogan gets his revenge on the whole town through a very nauseous way. And what's interesting to me is, yeah, while it's all that gross out boy humor that would work around a campfire, there's also this element of, hey, F you, world. F you for your expectations of me. F you for what the adults and what my peers, the pigeonhole that they put me into. And I feel like all of these boys around this campfire feel that to one extent or another. They feel like, hey, the world dealt me a raw deal, just like Lardass Hogan got a raw deal. And isn't it nice to just say, screw all this and screw all y'all? And I really love this inclusion within the context of the narrative.
To that point, I do really appreciate how much betting and wagering was going on in the town leading up to this. Like, this event which had no real value, except it was a small town and people were bored and this was the thing that they decided to wager on. And by Hogan subverting that, it was a very masculine move to say, no, I may look like the person who might have a chance of winning this based off of your notion of, you know, a winner may look like, despite the fact that he even goes out of his way to say that there was a very skinny boy in town who seemed to be able to eat quite a bit. But
shout out to Joey Chestnuts.
Is that what it was?
Joey Chestnuts is the winner of the American Hot Dog Eating Contest, who is a very skinny person who has finally brought the hot dog contest back to America. Whereas another skinny man from Japan had the most hot dogs for a long, long time.
So. Anyhow, so I love that idea of subverting the narrative. And that to me also is a very masculine thing to say, no, these are the rules. This is how you told me I should live my life. This is how you should tell me who wins and who's good. No, I'm going to make that up for myself. And if I can get back at some other people along the way, so much the better.
Yep.
That feels to me both very masculine, but also very 12-year-old boy masculine.
Very, very true. You know, we left our listeners with a bit of a cliffhanger last episode. I'd ask you the question, if we had known each other when we were 12, we knew each other 14, 15, so not too far removed, but if we had been fast friends when we were 12 and I had asked you to go on a journey with me to see a dead body, would you have?
I think I would have, but I think it would have required some convincing. But you were always good at that. You would be a goader in order to say, oh, yeah, you know, you want to go see this. And I'd be like, no, I come up with 100 excuses. But then at the end of the day, I'd probably come along with it.
It's interesting. For the longest time, while I always liked our friendship and valued it, I didn't understand why you were friends with me. Mm-hmm. And it only came into adulthood where I realized you kind of liked being goaded to an extent.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was something about the fact that I was doing things outside of your comfort zone and I could talk you into doing it with me that you appreciated. Where all this time, as a kid at least, I thought that you hated it and I wondered why you were ever going along with it. Now I understand you were just one of those people who just needed a little cajoling and you could get there and then maybe have a rich experience along with it.
I think that is exactly it. Well, before we wrap things up, I think it is time that we check in on paying the bills around here. This podcast does not produce itself.
Thankfully, we've got a literary sponsor this episode. It's always nice to kind of keep it in the family and promote other writers' works.
It's usually just some random tourist bureau.
From the author of Stud City comes a new short story. In a world of Pioneer Day festivals and blueberry regurgitant, comes a tour de force, The Revenge of Lardass Hogan by Gordon LaChance. Critics are calling it totally gross. All that puking was really cool, and it was good right up until the end.
Soon on newsstands throughout Central Maine, it's The Revenge of Lardass Hogan, coming spring of 1975, and the next issue of Cavalier Magazine.
So, let me get this straight. It's currently 2022.
Uh-huh.
And our sponsor is telling us to go buy a 47-year-old literary journal?
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense.
Beggars cannot be choosers in the podcast game.
Yeah.
And if they want to spend their hard-earned money on what is essentially now cultural ephemera, we'll take it.
Oh, I'll take it. I will stoop even lower than that. But with that, I do think that it is time that we say goodnight for this episode. As always, want to thank the Stardust Lounge. Crystal, again, these corpse survivors. I don't know, we might have to pick something different for the next episode. I feel like I'm revived at this point.
Yeah, I think we need to go something different for episode 3, just because 2 weeks of 6 or 7 corpse survivors has been a little too much for me to handle.
Mm-hmm. So for our listeners who maybe have had fewer than 6 or 7 corpse survivors who want to follow us, how might they do so?
Well, even though the corpse survivor might be too much for me to handle, our users can get a hold of us via our social media handles. Mm-hmm. At Literary Guys on Twitter and Instagram. They can also reach out to us at litguys@gmail.com. And please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this podcast. It really helps us kind of bring in more listeners and continue the dialogue and get a more varied and nuanced approach to masculinity, which is always the goal of this podcast.
Absolutely. So as always, with thanks to the Stardust Lounge here, it is time that we wrap things up. So this has been Literary Guys signing off.